Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
I last spoke to you, notwithstanding my recorded show of last Thursday. Too long. Much too much to talk about, much too little time. Well, I thought I'd start today with a rant from Steve Kruger, which expresses, as well as anybody, the usefulness of these ridiculous bailout programs that we've been hearing about over the last few days. And then we'll take it from there. His rant is entitled, "We Are Being Fixed. Ask the Cat How Well This Works," in parentheses. Well, Richard, the time has arrived again for our government to come to the rescue of we, the dumbass people. Washington has again chosen to solve a problem that was caused totally by government involvement in the free enterprise system in the first place. They are going to fix the mortgage problems. Can't you pay your mortgage? No problem. The government will come to the rescue. What a great idea. You can see why our lawmakers are well paid and some do actually pay taxes. Has any thought been given to whence this money will come? Well, I have. And at 70 years old, I know that I couldn't possibly live long enough to pay my share. Sorry to run out on you and leave you holding the bag, but I don't have 150 years left in me. It looks like our grandkids are stuck with a check on this one. About 6 weeks ago, I sent in a rant that said that if the government wanted us to keep spending, they should send every taxpayer $50,000. What do? They saddled every taxpayer with at least $100,000 in debt. What a nightmare. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. Yes, Steve, that is it. You hit several nails on the head at a stroke. All right, well, let me start with a piece of information that you should all know about, which is that Gerald Celente, who has been on this show and on Gary's show and is well known with his views and opinions to all of you, he will be showing on Friday, February the 20th, that is tomorrow, at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Eastern EST, on Fox News, Glenn Beck, for a one-hour special on Depression-era self-defense strategies. You might want to note this down again. It is no less than Gerald Celente, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern. For those listening to the archives, that was tomorrow. In other words, February the 20th, at 5 Eastern, and that will be on the Glenn Beck Show on Fox News for a one-hour special on Depression-era self-defense strategy. Well, I thought today I would like to talk to you a little bit about what I think might provide the background to very serious and searing social unrest in this country. It's got to come, and it has to come from a primary source, I believe, but it has to come because of certain things, certain elements or situations which will take place inevitably, one leading to the next, as it were. And I think I might have found, if not a timeline, a progress line for this particular grim and frightful situation that I'm afraid awaits us all here in the United States and, frankly, in many other parts of the world as well. And the reason for this is, in essence, that the financial wealth creation game is over. And I'm talking about the long-term modus operandi, if you like, of this country for many, many decades, really since the country became industrialized and has revved up and kind of geared up to lead a most unlikely role as the leader of the world, which is not to denigrate America or Americans, but simply to say that America was supposed to be the refuge, the land of the free. How it actually turned into the land of the world's policemen, I'm not really sure, but that's what happened. You see, the economies emerged from World War II relatively free from debt, which many people don't realize because they're hearing much more about the Great Depression and how much debt had to be unraveled at that point. But since then, since the end of the war, the 60-year global run-up has really run its course. And as I'm sure you're becoming more and more well aware now, finance capitalism is in a state of collapse, and all these marginal palliatives cannot possibly revive it. The U.S. economy cannot inflate its way out of debt, because quite apart from anything else, this would collapse the dollar and end its dreams of global empire by forcing foreign countries to go their own way. And as you all know, there's too little manufacturing to make the economy more competitive. And you all know about the high housing costs, the transportation, the debt, and the tax overhead. You know, a quarter to a third of U.S. real estate has now fallen into negative equity, which means people owe more on their houses than their houses are worth. And so obviously no banks are going to lend to them. The economy has hit a debt wall, and the economy itself is now falling into negative equity, where it may remain for as far as the eye can see, at least until there is a debt write-down. Now, the Obama recovery plan, which is based on infrastructure spending, will make real estate fortunes for well-situated properties along the new public transport routes, but there's absolutely no sign of cities levying a windfall property tax to save their finances. The mayors of these cities would rather keep the cities broke than to tax real estate and finance. The aim behind all this, of course, is to inflate property markets to enable owners to pay the banks, not to help the public sector break even. So state and local pension plans, which are already well underwater, will remain underfunded. And at the same time, more corporate pension plans will go broke. You know, you would think that the politicians would be willing to do the math and realize that debts that can't be paid will never be. But the debts are being kept on the books, continuing to extract interest to pay the creditors as have made the bad loans. And that results in a debt deflation which threatens to keep the economy in depression until a radical shift in policy occurs, a shift to save the real economy, not just the financial sector and the wealthiest 10% of American families. And the really alarming sign is that there is no evidence at all that Obama's economic advisors or the Treasury officials and the heads of the relevant congressional committees recognize the need for a write-down. You know, they've been placed in their positions precisely because they do not understand that debt leveraging is a form of economic overhead, not wealth creation. But you see, it's their tunnel vision that makes them so reliable to Wall Street. And Wall Street doesn't like surprises. The entire character of today's financial crisis continues to be labeled surprising and unexpected by the press as each new surprisingly pessimistic statistic hits the news. You see, it's safe to be surprised. It's suspicious to have expected bad news and being a premature doomsayer. You're supposed to have faith in the system above all. And of course, as we all know, the system was the Greenspan bubble. That's why Ayn Rand Allen was put in charge in the first place, after all. So what do we have? Well, we have the government trying to recover the happy bubble economy years by getting debt growing again, hoping to reinflate real asset and stock market prices. You know, that was, after all, the golden age of finance capital's world of using debt leverage to bid up the book price of fictitious capital assets. Everyone loved it, as long as it lasted. The voters thought they had a chance to become millionaires and approved happily. And, of course, it made Wall Street richer than ever before, while almost doubling the share of wealth held by the wealthiest 1% of America's families. For American Washington policymakers, they are synonymous with the economy, at least with the economy for which national economic policy is being formulated these days. You see, the Obama-Geithner plan to restart the bubble economy's debt growth so as to inflate asset prices by enough to pay off the debt overhang out of new capital gains cannot possibly work. But that's the only trick these ponies know. We have entered an era of asset price deflation, not inflation. Economic data charts throughout the world have hit a wall, and every trend has been plunging vertically downward since last autumn. U.S. consumer prices experienced their fastest plunge since the Great Depression of the 1930s, along with consumer so-called confidence. International shipping, real estate, stock market prices, oil, and the exchange rate for British sterling. The global economy is falling into depression. It cannot recover until all these debts have been written down. But instead of doing this, the government is doing just the opposite. It's proposing to take bad debts onto the public sector balance sheet, printing new treasury bonds, and giving the banks bonds whose interest charges will have to be paid by taxing labor and industry. It's madness of the first order. It cannot work. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call coming to you from Miami. And the offices of the Progressive Radio Network in New York are transmitting the show. If you want to call us, you may do so, and I should be very happy to receive the calls, as always. And to do this, you should dial 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. Okay. If you would like to email us with your questions and comments, you may do that too by emailing me at rmartin@latam.inv.com. That's Latam, LATAM, Inv for investments, INV, LATAMINV.com. Once more, rmartin@lataminv.com. And if you would like to call me personally to discuss your own finances or other matters of a personal nature, you may do that too by calling me on my direct line at 305-579-2012. Once more, it is 305-579-2012. Okay. Let's talk a little more about this. You see, when you have a period of looming collapse like we have right now, the wealthy elites protect their funds. In times past, they did this by buying gold when currencies started to weaken. But since the 1950s, the International Monetary Fund has made loans to support third world exchange rates long enough to subsidize capital flight. Now, let's talk a little bit about this International Monetary Fund, because it doesn't get much play in the press. They try to keep it as discreet as they possibly can, but I think it's useful for you to understand a little bit about how it works. Well, now, in the United States, over the past half year, Bankers and Wall Street investors have tapped the Treasury and Federal Reserve to support prices of their bad loans and financial gambles by buying out or guaranteeing $12 trillion of these junk debts. Protection for the U.S. financial elite thus takes the form of domestic public debt, not foreign currency. But you see, it's all in vain as far as the real economy is concerned. When the Treasury gives banks newly printed government bonds in cash for trash swaps, it leaves today's unpayably high private sector debt in place. All that happens is that this debt is now owed to or guaranteed by the government, which will have to impose taxes to pay the interest charges. The new twist is a variant on the IMF stabilization plans that lend money to central banks to support their currencies for long enough to enable local oligarchs and foreign investors to move their savings and investments offshore at a good exchange rate. The currency then is permitted to collapse, enabling currency speculators to rake in enough gains to empty out the central bank's reserves. Speculators view these central bank holdings as a target to be raided. The larger, the better. The IMF will lend a bank, say, $10 billion to support the currency. Domestic holders will flee the currency at a high exchange rate. Then, when the loan proceeds are depleted, the currency plunges. Wages are squeezed in the usual IMF austerity program, and the economy is forced to earn enough foreign exchange to pay back the IMF. As a condition for getting this kind of IMF, so-called support, governments are told to run a budget surplus, cut back social spending, lower wages, and raise taxes on labor so as to squeeze out enough exports to repay the IMF loans. But inasmuch as this kind of stabilization plan, so-called, cripples their domestic economy, they are obliged to sell off public infrastructure at distress prices to foreign buyers who themselves borrowed the money, and the effect is to make such countries even more dependent on less neoliberalized economies. So let's look at an example of this. Now, Latvia is a poster child for this kind of disaster. Its recent agreement with Europe is a case in point. To help the Swedish banks withdraw their funds from the sinking ship, European Union support is conditional on Latvia's government agreeing to cut salaries in the private sector and not to raise property taxes, which, by the way, are currently almost zero. The problem is that Latvia, like other post-Soviet economies, has scant domestic output to export. Industry throughout the former Soviet Union was torn up and scrapped in the 1990s. Welcome to victorious finance capitalism, Western style. What they had was real estate and public infrastructure free of debt and hence available to be pledged as collateral for loans to finance their imports. Ever since its independence from Russia in 1991, Latvia has paid for its imported consumer goods and other purchases by borrowing mortgage credit in foreign currency from Scandinavian and other banks. The effect has been one of the world's biggest property bubbles in an economy with no means of breaking even except by loading down its real estate with more and more debt. In practice, the loans took the form of mortgage borrowing from foreign banks to finance a real estate bubble and their import dependency on foreign suppliers. So instead of helping it and other post-Soviet nations develop self-reliant economies, the West has viewed them as economic oysters to be broken up to indebt them in order to extract interest charges and capital gains, leaving them empty shells. Well, this policy crested on July the 26th, 2009, when Joaquin Almunia of the European Commission wrote a letter to Latvia's Prime Minister spelling out the terms on which Europe would bail out the Swedish and other foreign banks operating in Latvia at Latvia's own expense. extended assistance is to be used to avoid a balance of payments crisis, which requires restoring confidence in the banking sector, now entirely foreign-owned, and bolstering the reserve, the foreign reserves of the Bank of Latvia. This implies financing outstanding government debt repayments, domestic and external. And if the banking sector were to experience adverse events, part of the assistance would be used for targeted capital infusions or appropriate short-term liquidity support. However, financial assistance is not meant to be used to originate new loans to businesses and households. Now, remember that it's important not to raise ungrounded expectations among the general public and the social partners, and equally to counter misunderstandings that may arise in this respect. Somewhat worryingly, we have witnessed some recent evidence in Latvian public debate of calls for part of the financial assistance to be used inter alia for promoting export industries or to stimulate the economy through increased spending at large. It is important actively to stem these misperceptions. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Riots broke out last week, and protesters stormed the Latvian Treasury. This is hardly surprising. There is no attempt to help Latvia develop the export capacity to cover its imports. After the domestic kleptocrats, foreign banks and investors have removed their funds from the economy, the Latvian lat, which is their currency, will be permitted to depreciate. Foreign buyers then can come in and pick up local assets on the cheap once again. The practice of European banks riding the crest of the post-Soviet real estate bubble is backfiring to wreck the European economies that have engaged in this predatory lending to neighboring economies as well. As one reporter has summarized, in Poland, 60% of mortgages are in Swiss francs. The zloty, which is the Polish currency, has just halved against the franc. Hungary, the Balkans, the Baltics, and Ukraine are all suffering variants of this story. As an act of collective folly by lenders and borrowers, it matches America's subprime debacle. There is a crucial difference, however. European banks are on the hook for both. U.S. banks are not. Almost all East European bloc debts are owed to Western Europe, especially Austrian, Swedish, Greek, Italian, and Belgian banks. This was the West's alternative to Stalinism. It didn't help these countries emulate how Britain and America got rich by protectionist policies and publicly nurtured industrialization and infrastructure spending. Rather, the financial rape and industrial dismantling of the former Soviet economies was the most recent exercise in Western colonialism. At least U.S. investors were smart enough to stand clear and merely ride the stock market run-up before jumping ship. But now the government's plan to save the economy is to save the banks, along similar lines to the West trying to save its banks from their adventure in the post-Soviet economies. This is the basic neoliberal economic plan after all. The U.S. economy is about to be post-Sovietized. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's extremely important to get this, because when these bailouts fail and you see how the banks move against the consumer in this country to collect on what it's owed, you will see the direct beginnings of what will cause social and civic unrest in this country. But you have to understand the background first, which is why it's very important that you get this, that you understand what I have just explained to you. Now, this is a new departure. We haven't talked about this before, ever. So I imagine that this might be somewhat perplexing to you. And quite frankly, it might be worth your while to listen just to what I've mentioned once again when this talk comes up in the archives, because I assure you it is important. In the meantime, let's take some email. I think it would be fun to go back over some of what we've had so far. I got an impassioned call from Sheila Nolan today. Well, it was actually an email saying, "Dear God, Richard, please send us some good news." There has to be some one thing that you can put a positive spin on. Please! With about 15 E's. We're all going to need pharmaceuticals soon.
Sheila Nolan?
Yes, well, Sheila, I'm not here to, paint over the cracks on this one, I'm afraid. When things do get better, I assure you I will try and be ahead of the game on that one. But it doesn't really work for the moment. Got to face the music, I'm afraid, Sheila, there. All right, Guy Pullman wrote it, and the subject is California Report. Actually, Los Angeles is the subtitle here. Richard, the current trade imbalance of the United States has a major component in the form of an unnecessary reliance on foreign oil. The main culprit, the SUV. Los Angelinos are so caught up in the star glamour of Hollywood that they believe they need to ride high and feel glamorous just like the movie stars they idolize. There are just so few actual movie stars living in Los Angeles year-round, and there are 2 million wannabes pretending to be in their shoes. The SUV craze is merely an easy power play, a convenient way for these people to feel on top. The other component of this idiocy is a direct result of an obesity problem that has been building since the 60s and directly connected to the fast food industry. Fully 30% of all Americans are obese, and 30% of the population frequents fast food restaurants. In my observations of people driving in SUVs around Los Angeles, I find that most of them are overweight. These people cannot fit into a regular car. The other part of the obesity component has to be easy credit. Easy credit has led Americans to be grossly overconsumptive of food. Easy credit has led to obesity, has led to a gross reliance on big gas guzzlers. There you have it, Richard, from a native Los Angelino's sociological perspective on consumption, oil, SUVs, and the fast food society. Keep your eye on the road, Guy Pullman.
Thank you, Guy.
My goodness, you really have taken a leaf out of Steve's book here, haven't you? I like to see that the tradition is being proudly carried on. All right. Luciano wrote in 2 days ago, and he says, "Hi, Richard. I hope everything is fine at your end. Is there a way I can help you so all your recorded programs are syndicated? It is hard and time-consuming to find important information you presented in your programs without syndication. In one of your programs, you mentioned that you will let us know when it is a good time to buy gold. Do you think the time has come? Regards, Luciano." Luciano or Luciano, I'm not sure how you pronounce your name, I must tell you that despite the considerable run-up in the price of gold, I am still not prepared to give it the green light until the deflationary period of this downturn has run its course. And we are very far from that right now, Luciano. I'm sorry, but this is not any time to be considering inflation. And as such, you want to be very, very cautious. I will note that when you look at some of these markets, some like silver, for example, which is way, way below its own recent highs of last year, or platinum, which is still down about 50% from its recent highs, and likewise palladium, the fact that gold has run up tolerably close to its own previous highs is a very suspicious function to me. Most of these markets run in sync, and the precious metals market is no exception. So I urge you all to be very careful, because I think we could see a considerable downdraft. If and when it becomes time to buy gold, from my perspective, ladies and gentlemen, you will be the first to know. Okay. Then I have Phyllis, who wrote in saying, "Hello, Richard. Do you think we should assume that prices of art are bubbled like the other bubbles? I have a Cassandra poster that has always been too big to hang up, and I'd just as soon sell it. Would immediately be a good time. I could pay off a credit card with the proceeds. What are your general thoughts about the art market? As ever, thank you for your generosity to us, Phyllis. Could you devote a segment to buying or not buying gold in the near future?" It is quite extraordinary how many people are thinking about gold. I am always a little bit uneasy when everybody seems to be piling on a particular investment. It really means that if behind the scenes everybody is buying, then we're very close to a point where there are no more buyers, at least no more aggressive buyers. So I do urge you to be very, very careful, ladies and gentlemen. As far as the art market is concerned, I definitely think it's peaked, most certainly, yes. and I would sell your Cassandra poster, and indeed pay off your credit cards. In fact, I'd pay off your credit cards before that if I were you. I don't want these bankers thinking they can rub their hands, wondering and hoping, you know, whether you can or can't find a buyer for your artwork so they can go on getting interest off your credit card debt. Much, much better, Phyllis, to get rid of that credit card debt. That's my advice to you. All right, well, let's talk a little bit more. Now you've understood a little bit about how the IMF works, and it's not a pretty picture, as I'm sure you have appreciated. Looking at the recent Obama bailout, it is actually arranged very much like an IMF loan to support the exchange rate of foreign currency, but with the Treasury supporting financial asset prices for U.S. banks and other financial institutions. Instead of banks and oligarchs abandoning the dollar, the aim is to enable them to dump their bad mortgages and CDOs and get domestic treasury bonds. Private sector debt will be moved onto the U.S. government balance sheet, where taxpayers, as usual, will bear the losses, which is to say mainly labor, not Wall Street. Inasmuch as the financial sector has been freed of income tax liability by the small print in last fall's Paulson-Bush bailout package. But at least the U.S. government is handling the situation entirely in domestic dollars, which of course gives them a huge leg up. It gives them an enormous advantage over countries where they have to consider the exchange rate as well as the debts that they incur. But as in third world austerity programs, the effect of keeping debts in place at the real economy's expense will be to shrink the domestic U.S. market while providing opportunities for hedge funds to pick up depreciated assets cheaply as the federal government, states, and cities sell them off. This is called letting the banks earn their way out of debt. It's strangling the real economy because not a dollar of the government's response has been devoted to reducing the overall debt volume. Take the much vaunted $50 billion program designed to renegotiate mortgages downward for so-called troubled homeowners. Well, if you look closely, you'll see that the real beneficiaries are the giant leading banks such as Citibank and Bank of America that have made the bad loans. The Treasury will take on the bad debts that the banks are stuck with, and will permit mortgagees to renegotiate their monthly payment down to 38% of their income. But rather than the banks taking the loss as they should do for overlending, the Treasury itself will make up the difference and pay it to the banks so that they will be able to get what they hope to get. The hapless mortgage-burdened family stuck in their negative equity home turns out to be merely a passive vehicle for the Treasury to pass debt relief onto the commercial banks. Very few news stories have made this clear, but the Financial Times did spell out the details buried in small print. It added that the Treasury has not yet decided whether to write down the principal debt for the estimated 15 million families with negative equity, and perhaps 30 million by this time next year as property prices continue to plunge. No doubt a similar deal will be made. For every $100,000 of write-down in debt owed by over-mortgaged homeowners, the bank will receive $100,000 from the Treasury. Government debt will rise by $100,000, and the process will continue until the Treasury has transferred $50 million to the banks that made the reckless loans. There is enough for just 500,000 of these renegotiations of $100,000 each. It may seem like a big amount, but it's only about 1/30th of the properties underwater. Hardly enough to make much of a dent, but the principle has been put in place for many further bailouts. It will take almost an infinity of them as long as the Treasury tries to support the fiction that the miracle of compound interest can be sustained for long. The economy may be dead by the time saner economic understanding penetrates the public consciousness. In the meantime, bad private sector debt will be shifted onto the government's balance sheet. Interest and amortization currently owed to the banks will be replaced by obligations to the U.S. Treasury. Taxes will be levied to make up the bad debts with which the government is stuck. the real economy will pay Wall Street, and they will be paying for decades. Calling the $12 trillion giveaway to bankers a subprime crisis makes it appear that bleeding-heart liberals got Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into trouble by insisting that these public-private institutions make irresponsible loans to the poor. The party line is, blame the victim. But we know this is false. The bulk of bad loans are concentrated in the largest banks. It was Countrywide and other banksters that led the irresponsible lending and brought heavy-handed pressure on Fannie Mae. Most of the nation's smaller local banks didn't make such reckless loans. The big mortgage shops didn't care about loan quality because they were run by salesmen. The Treasury is paying off the gamblers and billionaires by supporting the value of bank loans, investments, and derivative gambles, leaving the Treasury in debt. Neoliberal economics has turned America and the West into a failed economy. There is really no alternative. The neoliberals have made the shift of planning from governments to the financial oligarchy irreversible. The Western economies cannot go on the way they have been. They have reached the point where the debts exceed the ability to pay. Instead of recognizing this fact and scaling debts back into line with the ability to pay, the Obama-Geithner plan is to bail out the big banks and hedge funds, keeping the volume of debt in place and indeed growing once again through the so-called magic of compound interest. The result can only be an increasingly extractive economy until households, real estate, and industrial companies, states and cities, and the national government itself is driven into debt peonage. Well, that's what I have for you. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, this is quite difficult to appreciate. It is, as I say, a new concept that I have for you. I see that I need to develop this in much more detail, because this is, in a sense, the end run. This is where we are going before the final crunch. And, of course, the final crunch will be when there is not just tax revolts, but general unrest, as you've seen in some of these Eastern European countries, of which Latvia is only one. And I assure you, there is little or no difference between Latvia and what's happening in the United States. And because the IMF is, in essence, a United States institution, the fact that the government simply takes over what I described to you as being the IMF policies will become clear once the fact that it's been somewhat disguised has taken its course, as it would be today, for example. Nobody in this country compares themselves with an average Latvian, but I assure you that, in essence, there is no difference. You know, European banks may be in a far worse shape than American ones. Bruno Waterfield of the London Daily Telegraph reports to have seen an eyes-only document prepared by the European Commission for the finance ministers of the various EU member countries. The problem that was revealed in the report is an estimated write-down by European banks in the range of about £16 trillion or about $25 trillion US dollars. And the concern is that bailing out the various national banks for such an unbelievable amount would push the cost of government borrowing to much higher levels than we see today. Now, Europe is somewhat larger than the US. So think what the reaction here would be if the US decided to borrow $25 trillion to bail out the US banks. The dollar would be crucified. And this is, of course, why the euro is getting weaker all the time. You know, and it will continue to get a lot weaker if bank problems are even half of what the report says they are. Sterling is already off almost 30% from its recent highs, and depending on what the real damage is to the banking system, it could get much, much worse. And Waterfield reports, and I quote, "National leaders and EU officials share fears that a second bank bailout in Europe will raise government borrowing at a time when investors, particularly those who lend money to European governments, have growing doubts over the ability of countries such as Spain, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Britain to pay it back." And I continue with the quote. The commission figure is significant because of the role EU officials will play in devising rules to evaluate toxic bank assets later this month. New moves to bail out banks will be discussed at an emergency EU summit at the end of February. The EU is deeply worried at widening spreads on bonds sold by different European countries. End of quote. See, part of the problem is that European banks were far more highly leveraged than US banks. Some banks were reportedly leveraged 50 to 1. And they lent money to Eastern European projects and businesses, which are now facing severe financial strain and plummeting local currencies. So you see where this all ties in with what we've been talking about in the Latvian situation. $25 trillion, ladies and gentlemen. Think about that. Even $5 trillion would be daunting. But the problem for Europe is that it doesn't have a central bank that can step in and selectively save banks from one country without taking on all Eurozone member country banks. Yet some countries may not have the wherewithal to save their own banks. It's being reported now that some Austrian banks are hoping that Germany will step in and save them. Well, given Germany's problems, they may have a long wait. Nouriel Roubini estimates that U.S. bank losses at some $1.7 to $1.8 trillion out of a total of about $3 trillion in total financial system losses. His base assumptions are not all that bearish, given what we know, which is a 5% GDP contraction and 9% unemployment, with housing prices down another 20%. All those estimates, by the way, are quite plausible. So I want you to keep that in mind, you know, as we move through this situation. And by the way, that this problem is not just an American problem. In fact, in many parts of the world, it's actually much, much worse. George from Long Island is on standby. Well, George, you're on the air. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Richard. How are you today?
Okay, thanks.
Could you discuss credit default swaps and how it affects American banks?
Yeah, I've done that before. I've discussed credit default swaps before. It's a long story, George. I'd like to do that. And what I think I'm going to do, I'm going to make a note, and I will talk about it maybe next week. It's really, in order to get a full picture of this, it's too complicated to deal in just a few minutes. But I certainly will. I'm just making a note here so that I can prepare something for you. I'll do that. It has been a while since I've discussed credit default swaps. Obviously, you've seen the meltdown in these swaps and basically how they have, taken bank equity to zero. I mean, in 24 hours, this is basically what happened with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. Is that when their credit default swaps were marked to market, it was found that they had no equity, so they were basically impoverished overnight, which, by the way, is why I think you should all be very cautious about where you keep your money and which bank you keep your money, because there's not going to be much warning when they ring the bell here. But the essence behind credit default swaps is the enormous leverage that was taken on in these contracts by the banks and the hedge funds, and many other large-scale institutions, such as insurance companies, basically to play upon a rising housing market. And all was well, of course, until the implosion of the housing market, and then these credit default swaps started to implode along with the leverage that they had, meaning that the small amount of equity was wiped out very, very quickly. And that's why the government has had to come in and organize these massive bailouts, basically to stand behind the credit default swaps. George, I know I'm always, very I have a tendency to move into these subject matters very quickly, and I must restrain myself because to do a story on credit default swaps really requires me to go back, to basics. And I will do that because I think a lot of you are fairly new here, and I haven't talked much about them since actually before the implosion, when I did, as you may remember, talk in quite a lot of detail on a lot of shows about credit default swaps and what they were and how they worked. So with your indulgence, George, I'm going to leave it until Hopefully, I might be able to do this next week.
A fair question, Richard, before you run on that.
Yeah.
Is that their profits, or are you talking about our investment money in the bank, our depository? Is that involved in the credit default swaps, or is it just their profit?
Oh, no, it's not even that. Well, I mean, basically, it's their capital that they put
all
behind
capital,
it.
Including our money?
Yes, in essence, yes. Don't forget, it isn't your money. When you put money in a bank, George, that you don't have any money anymore. You actually have no money. You have a credit with the bank. It's not like putting your money with a broker. When you put your money in with a broker, that money is segregated by law. So it's always yours, and you always have access to it, and you always know where it is. When you put money in a bank, you no longer have the money. The idea is that the bank makes its money by paying you a certain interest on the basis of which they derive hopefully greater interest by lending it out to somebody else. So when you talk about euphemistically your money, I'm afraid you have a nasty shock coming when you go into the bank tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. and ask for $100,000 out in cash. They're going to say, sorry, but no way, because they don't have that money. They're going to have to get it, and they probably will get it. It might take them a few days. But if you go back there, you know, towards the end of next week, you have a chance, you know, that they'll have your money for you. But this is something that most people don't understand, that money in the bank belongs to the bank. It doesn't actually belong to you. You just have a credit with the bank. And, of course, this calls into question the whole issue of the way in which money is lent out by the banks, according to the fractional lending system, where banks are allowed to lend out a certain fraction of what they have, or a certain multiple of what they have, which is usually somewhere between 10% and 15%. So imagine your money being lent out at, say, 10 times the amount that you put in the bank, on the basis of which further credit and leverage was taken in the purchase of these credit default swaps, which could be another up to, you know, 50-to-1 leverage. When those credit default swaps go under, George, you don't have a hope. I mean, you don't have an earthly of getting your money back, which is why the FDIC upped the insurance limits from $100,000 to $250,000. To restore confidence in the banking system. I mean, don't tell them I told you this, but they don't have $250,000 per depositor for even a tenth, or probably even a hundredth of the total banking assets which might be called upon by depositors. It's a grim and terrible situation, and unfortunately, there is no solution. And that's what we've been talking about all the way along. It's very frightening, George.
When do you feel the shoe's going to drop on these deals?
Well, they've started to drop, haven't they? I mean, you started to see deals go under. Some of the UBS is having problems right now. Many of these hedge funds are going out of business. The banks themselves are having severe problems. You know, Bank of America is in dire straits right now. You know, all these banks which have gone under, you can go to bankimplode.com and get the current figures of how many banks have gone under. And that's why I say it doesn't matter how much money that the Fed puts into the system. It's not going to cause inflation because, A, it's going to be overwhelmed by the amount of money which is disappearing as a result of bankruptcies and other forms of foreclosures and defaults. And B, what money is left, the banks refuse to lend out. So it's as if there was no money coming into the system. That's basically, you know, what Obama and Geithner have tried to get around. In other words, pushing more money at people who really don't need it. And, you know, yes, in answer to all your questions, I'm afraid.
Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate the information.
Thank you. Okay. Well... let's have a look. I had some more emails here, which I wanted to read to you, and I've just got to find them. It's been a little bit of time here. I was interested in an article by Mark Farber, who is a Swiss analyst and commentator who is very, very well known, and many of you will have heard him on television or seen what he's written. And it's always worth reading what he says. And he said something I thought was very interesting the other day. He said that the world has gone from the greatest synchronized global economic boom in history to the first synchronized global bust since the Great Depression. How we got here is not a cautionary tale of free markets gone wild. Rather, it's the story of what can happen when governments ignore market signals and central bankers believe in endless booms. And going into some of the history of it, he says, following the March 2000 NASDAQ bust, the Federal Reserve began to slash the Fed funds rate from 6.5% in January 2001 to 1.75% by year end, and then to 1% in 2003. This despite the fact that officially the U.S. economy had begun to recover in November 2001. Almost 3 years into the economic expansion, the Fed began to increase the Fed funds rate in baby steps beginning in June 2004 from 1% to 5.25% in August 2006. But because interest rates during this time continuously lagged behind nominal GDP growth as well as cost of living increases, the Fed never truly implemented tight monetary policies. Indeed, total credit increased in the U.S. from an annual growth rate of 7% in the June 2004 quarter to over 16% in early 2007. It grew five times faster than nominal GDP between 2001 and 2007. The complete mispricing of money, combined with a cornucopia of financial innovations, led to the housing boom and allowed buyers to purchase homes with no down payments and homeowners to refinance their existing mortgages. A consumption boom followed, which was not accompanied by equal industrial production and capital spending increases. Consequently, the U.S. trade and current account deficit expanded, the latter from 2% of GDP in 1998 to 7% in 2006, thus feeding the world with approximately $800 billion in excess liquidity that year. When American consumption began to boom on the back of the housing bubble, the explosion of imports into the U.S. were largely provided by China and other Asian countries. Rising exports from China led that country's strong economic industrial production, income, and consumption gains, as well as very high capital spending as capacities needed to be expanded in order to meet the export demand. An economic boom in China drove the demand for oil and other commodities up. Rapidly accumulating wealth allowed the resource producers in the Middle East, Latin America, and elsewhere to go on a shopping binge for luxury goods and capital goods from Europe and Japan. As a consequence of this expansionary cycle, the world experienced between 2001 and 2007 the greatest synchronized economic boom in the history of capitalism. Past booms of the 19th century under colonial economies or after World War II, when 40% of the world's population remained under communism, socialism, or was otherwise isolated, were not nearly as global as this one. Another unique feature of this synchronized boom was that nearly all asset prices skyrocketed around the world. Real estate, equities, commodities, art, even bonds. Meanwhile, the Fed continued to claim that it was impossible to identify any asset bubbles. The cracks first appeared in the U.S. in 2006, when home prices became unaffordable and risk-averse, while risk financial institutions tightened lending standards. In 2008, a collapse in all asset prices led to lower U.S. consumption, which caused plunging exports, lower industrial production, and less capital spending in China. This led to a collapse in commodity prices and in the demand for luxury goods and capital goods from Europe and Japan. The virtuous upcycle turned into a vicious downcycle with an intensity not witnessed since before World War II. Sadly, government policy responses, not only in the U.S., are plainly wrong. It is not that the free market failed. The mistake was constant interventions in the free market by the Fed and the U.S. Treasury that addressed the symptoms and postponed problems instead of solving them. The bad policy started with the bailout of Mexico following the tequila crisis in 1994. This prolonged the Asian bubble of the 1990s because investors became convinced there was no risk in growing current account deficits and continued to finance Asia's economic economies until the bubble burst with the start of the Asian crisis in 1997-98. Then came the ill-advised bailouts of long-term capital management in 1998, which encouraged the financial sector to leverage up even more. This was followed by the ultra-expansionary monetary policies following the NASDAQ bubble in 2000, which led to rapid and unsustainable credit growth. So what now? Unfortunately, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner were, as Fed officials, among the chief architects of easy money and are therefore largely responsible for the credit bubble that got us here. Worse, their commitment to meddling in markets has only intensified with the adoption of near-zero interest rates and massive bank bailouts. The best policy response would be to do nothing and let the free market correct the excesses brought about by unforgivable policy errors. Further interventions through ill-conceived bailouts and bulging fiscal deficits are bound to prolong the agony and lead to another slump, possibly an inflationary depression with dire social consequences. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, I keep mentioning this. I try to describe this in sort of different ways so that you will have the best chance, as it were, of grappling with the problem. Nobody can say we haven't discussed this, but it is a mouthful and it's difficult to understand. And those of you who are not familiar with economic concepts will probably receive your aha moment at different times and according to different explanations of the same thing. But all of which to tell you that really, you know, this is a structural depression. You know, I don't think these markets will, or the economy will come back for a very long time, perhaps decades. You see, there are two key failures in how authorities are attempting to deal with this collapse. Firstly, the bank debt must be sufficiently reduced before credit expansion, or otherwise known as reflation, can occur. This is absolutely sine qua non. It has to happen. But this is not being addressed at all in any manner whatsoever. On the contrary, taxpayers and consumers are burdened by higher fixed costs, taxes, finance, and bank costs, which leave less to support the economy. See, ideally, the debt burden could be helped by price and wage inflation like in the 1970s, but the system cannot be reflated because of this wage arbitrage, meaning that, you know, the American workers are simply not competitive with workers from the Asian countries anymore. And the other way, the other key failure in how these authorities are attempting to deal with the collapse is in the idea that globalism, as manifested in wage arbitrage, is the evil that would delay the economies from recovering from the depression. That is why this downturn is structural. Wage arbitrage distorts key economic market principles. The invisible hand's role in pricing. All economic systems are essentially local. When prices and wages become distorted, the global flow of funds becomes unbalanced, accelerating build-up of bank credit and debt. For example, to finance global trade, Chinese banks will increase their bank credit, while U.S. consumers will increase their own debt. So really the problem does lie in the United States. I mean, this is the pivotal point of the crisis. The rest of the world is simply not decoupling. And the rest of the world really has its own economic origins of crisis in the United States. And as I always say, and to conclude this rather grim, you know, wake-up call, The poster boy here is Greenspan. I mean, Greenspan is the absolute arch enemy of everybody today, in my opinion, and will remain so for decades to come. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're at the end of our wake-up call again on Thursday. We will be back at the normal time on Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's been my pleasure, as always, to talk to you. This is Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake-Up Call, wishing you a very happy and relaxed weekend. Until Monday. Bye-bye.